Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhouseonline.com.au.
Now, you grew up as the eldest kid in a church-going, homeschooling kind of family. Tell us a bit about those carefree days before your cancer diagnosis.
I grew up in definitely a very loving family. Yeah, it was very, as you said, we were very, very religious, very sort of strict. But, I think the strictness was certainly born out of my parents' desire to have what's best for me. And at that time, my brother was 2 years younger than me, and I had a brother who was like 1 year old, and my sister wasn't born for a number of years. Those were good times. I guess the biggest thing that stands out in my mind before I had cancer was that I loved to play soccer. Soccer was like the sport I played, and that was like my ambition in life, was to be a great soccer player.
What did this context, this background, this family environment, what kind of impact did that have on you to help you with your challenges in future life?
Well, I think that, it had this sort of, I would say, all the impact in the world. I think people are often sort of like, wow, you overcame all these big problems when you were like 9 years old. That's really amazing. But I don't think I can really take much of the credit for that, because I think that, any 9 year old is so much the product of their environment, of their parents or their caregivers and the home that they live in. And so I think that I was blessed to live in a really great home and have really great parents. And I think that to a large degree is what I would credit with my ability to sort of get through the things that I faced.
Well, let's talk about those traumas. You were diagnosed with a cancer called Ewing's sarcoma at age 9. You went through several months of chemo to try and remove a tumor in your left leg. Then finally, at age 10, you had to have the leg amputated at the hip. What were some of those emotions you went through as a 9 to 10-year-old facing that kind of trauma?
When I first found out that my leg might be amputated, it seemed like my life was over, because, like I said before, the thing that I loved to do was to play soccer. And so it seemed like, if I had one leg, it was almost like, what is there to live for? Like, what possible reason would I have to be alive if I can't play soccer anymore? So that was kind of the initial shock of it. And definitely it was, I just remember in the weeks leading up to the amputation, just basically just crying all the time and just feeling like everything was over. But it was sort of like I did my grieving before I lost my leg. When you lose a limb, it's like losing a family member or a friend or something in an emotional sense, that you feel just this sort of sense of emotional loss. But I think that in the same way, maybe like it sometimes could be easier emotionally, if let's say your grandparent dies, but you saw it coming, for over a period of years and you kind of had time to say goodbye and stuff. In the same way, I think it's probably better to know ahead of time that you're going to lose a leg, like to cancer, like that happened, rather than to lose it in an accident where all of a sudden you have this physical trauma and the emotional trauma losing a limb all at once. I think that would be really difficult. So I think it was fortunate in that I had sort of, several, probably about a month heads up before the actual amputation.
How did you get through it all?
The biggest credit I would have to give is to, my parents, my loving family, and sort of to the faith in God that I had at that age. But I think just from a pure psychological standpoint, the most important thing to me at that time was finishing. Finishing the chemotherapy, having my hair grow back, getting energy again, not having to worry about cancer anymore. And it was really like every day, that's what I thought about, was getting to that day when the chemotherapy would be done.
What were some of the bigger challenges you faced when you began to tackle life as a kid, now growing up with one leg?
I think that the social aspects of it are always the biggest, probably for any age, whether you're a child or an adult, because you kind of return into your previous social environment, but as a person who looks totally different than you did before and than everyone else does. And so it was certainly scary, and I wondered how are people going to react to me? Will my friends still be my friend? Are people going to stare at me? Will people ever, be interested in talking to me anymore? I don't know. It's just, so many questions that run through your mind. So I think that's probably the biggest thing. And then, of course, the other side of it is the physical side of, how will I get around? How will I take showers? Will I be able to get a job? Can I go to school if I have one leg? Which, a lot of these things seem kind of silly to me now, because, of course, you can do all those things. And, of course, I've been able to adapt. But when you're first faced with it, when you're first faced with any sort of new physical disability like that, you just have all those questions that run through your mind.
And people don't help with this. I imagine as a teen it would have been pretty tough as well.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. You know, the way I've always thought of it is that recovering from the psychological aspects and just adapting to having a disability like that, I think there's sort of new layers of it as you get older. You know, when you're 10, you sort of deal with it as a 10-year-old, or when you're 15, you deal with it as a 15-year-old, and when you're 20, you deal as a 20-year-old. And so, yeah, as you get older, you have this sort of new level of maturity and a new peer group and a new way of looking at yourself. And you kind of have to readjust and say, okay, now that I'm in this age of my life, what does it mean now to have that physical disability?
You ended up taking some snow skiing lessons from an instructor who coached one-legged skiers, and you discovered a passion for ski racing. How much did your newfound sport mean to you?
Well, then a tremendous amount, because I couldn't, like I said, couldn't play soccer anymore. But as soon as I started skiing, like literally the first day, you know, I was naturally pretty good at it. And I guess what I immediately recognized and grabbed onto was the fact that I could ski as well with one leg as anyone could ski with two legs. You know, I could be just as fast as everyone else on the mountain. And I think that's what immediately said, you know, to me, like, wow, this is something that I should do, and this is something I really want to pursue.
Now, it's a big leap from just enjoying a sport to deciding you want to make it into a Paralympic team. Your book talks about things like the huge fundraising efforts, the mental battles, and having to relocate your life to the ski fields as you get serious. What gave you the drive to keep working for years towards that dream?
That's a great question. I think part of it was that just because, there's a number of steps, and I didn't get really serious until I was about 16 is when I kind of started going full time for it. And I guess, you know, at that age, there was part of me that felt like I had missed something in my childhood. I'd missed the chance to kind of play sports and be competitive with people my own age, because when most people were doing those sorts of things, I was in the hospital, or I was learning how to use my crutches and artificial leg. And so I kind of missed that element of my life. And also, I think I was just sort of still a competitive person and attracted to the idea of a challenge, you know, the idea of competing and training at an elite level and then competing competing at that, like, international level. And so, yeah, I don't know. It was just something that was just really enthralling to me. I think I was just very passionate about it. And I've always thought that, you know, if you find something that really excites you, that you're really passionate about, then you should chase after it.
Even with that, I guess, getting used to having one leg, still the extremes of training must have taken its toll on you physically and emotionally.
It's pretty intense, and you know, in a lot of ways, I'm glad I did it when I was like 18, 19, 20, 21, and when I was like a little bit younger, because I mean, I'm still pretty young, I'm 25, but there's no way my body could take the beating now that it took like 10 years ago when I was skiing like every day. Because yeah, it's just super intense, man. Like, skiing is so dangerous, and it's so hard on your knees, and if you just have one leg, it's, you know, all the force of every turn is going into that one knee. So yeah, I'm very pleased that my body held up as well as it did while I was racing.
You talk about suffering from depression when you reached college age. In fact, you almost gave in on your Paralympic dream, and you had to spend some time with a therapist working through some of the issues that had been buried deep down since childhood. Is that a common experience among young people who've suffered a serious childhood illness or an amputation?
That's a good question. I think that it's a common occurrence for anyone who suffered an amputation at any age, that it's always sort of expected, as I said, that you're going to go through a grieving process just the way that you would if you lost a family member or a friend. And like I said before, you know, I think that grieving process is like, it's lifelong. And so I think that for me, I guess I was sort of starting to deal with a lot of it in a different way. Yeah, when I was about 20 years old. And I think a lot of it also was not just having one leg, but like having the cancer and the way that cancer affected me, you know, like coming sort of close to death at a relatively young age, you know, at 10 years old, having a 50% chance to live. I think it really instilled in me this sort of fear of, oh my gosh, you know, I could die at any time. I really need to make sure that I live my life to the fullest and I really make my life count. And there's certainly like a positive side of that, and that's generally speaking a good thing, but like any good thing taken to the extreme, it can be too much. And so I think I became sort of, obsessed with that idea of living life to the fullest and really going after everything, you know, to the point that I just burned myself out.
Now, in 2006, after all of this, you finally made it into the Paralympic Games in Italy. How did it feel to finally put on that uniform after all those years of hard work?
Yeah, it was really amazing. You know, a lot of the years that I was training, I didn't really think that I was going to make the team. It was more just training because I didn't want to look back with regrets and look back and wonder, oh, what if I had trained, you know? And so it was really kind of a surprise that I made it there and that I did get to wear that uniform. And so, there's some people that go to the Paralympics or the Olympics thinking, all right, I'm here to, like, win a gold medal. Whereas for me, I went thinking, wow, like, this is so amazing that I'm here. And so, yeah, it was a really meaningful experience in that sense. And also having my parents there, I think, was really special, both for me and for them.
What did you feel coming away from the experience?
Really, you know, when I look back on it, and this is kind of why I decided to write the book, was because, it's just, to me, it's almost uncanny, like, how well things turned out for me. You know, you could have never come to me as a 9-year-old and convinced me, hey, you're going to lose your leg and it seems like everything is over. But years later, you're going to, like, be one of the best ski racers in the world and you're going to be on the U.S. team. You're going to go to the Paralympics. Like, I would have never even believed that was possible. And so I guess that's sort of the idea that I took away from it.
You were deeply inspired by the character Jake Sully in the movie Avatar. Did you see some of yourself in that story?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, it's really interesting to watch it, to watch the movie as a person with a disability. I related to, you know, that, I don't know if you saw it, you know, that scene, like, when he first is in his avatar body and he runs through that garden. And to me, that was a little bit like the way it was, you know, when I first started skiing, that there was this kind of, like, this sort of physical freedom there, sort of freedom from the otherwise constricting bonds of being disabled. And I think that I did really relate to it in that way.
In your book, you say your relationship with God sustained you through your trials and gave you hope for the future, but you also reveal some real battles and questioning God that you went through. Did your faith take some blows through the tough times, or did it take on a stronger quality?
I think some of both. I think that, you know, when you go through sort of a difficult period of your life, that's when, you know, as far as faith is concerned, when kind of the rubber meets the road, I don't know if that's an expression you guys use down under, but it's like when it's like it really matters. That's kind of the test. And I think that, yeah, I can strengthen it or can weaken it. And I think that for me, as a child, I think a lot of it was more strengthening. It was kind of like, oh, I've grown up with these sort of Christian principles, and, you know, that my parents have told me that I should pray to God, and, you know, these sort of just ideas floating around my mind. And then all of a sudden, wow, I might die, and wow, I have cancer, and I might lose my leg. And all of a sudden, kind of, you start asking much bigger questions than most 9-year-olds would ask. And sort of faith became, I guess, more real and more relevant to me at that age. I think for the most part, it's been something that's drawn me closer to God and to the importance of spirituality.
You're now a professional motivational speaker for high schools, conventions, Fortune 500 corporations, and also the White House. What's the message that you bring to your audiences?
Well, I think it was like I was saying earlier that, that things have turned out for me better than I could have ever imagined. And I think that there's always audience members and I think a piece of every person in the audience that feels like, man, they're facing this impossible task, you know, whatever it might be, whether, you know, it might be health related or a relationship or a job situation. And I think that deep down, we all want to believe that there's hope, you know, that things might turn out well. And I think that it's tremendously affirming for people then to be able to hear a story like mine, whether that's in my speech or whether it's in my book or whatever, to hear that story and to say, yeah, like, that things would have turned out well for that guy, maybe they can turn out well for me. And so that's kind of the message I try to bring by sharing my story when I give speeches.
I've enjoyed looking at your videos on YouTube. You've got quite a collection there, including the Single Shoes song and the amputee rap, which apparently has been translated into Creole and played to thousands of Haitians who've had to have amputations after the earthquake. Is that true?
One of my videos did get translated into Creole. Apparently, I just got an email today saying apparently it was shown on national TV in Haiti. I'm not sure how many people actually have televisions in Haiti, but to the extent that there's national TV, apparently they showed a video of mine the other day there, which is pretty cool.
I like the concept behind the single shoe song, the fact that it's because people ask you all the time, what do you do with that left shoe? And there's that awkwardness, I suppose, as you walk up to a door. That's from the amputee rap where, you know, people open it for you or they don't know what to do. How do you deal with these issues, these common social etiquette dilemmas?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, because people are naturally going to try and open the door for me. And, you know, it's like I can open a door fine myself. You know, I figured that out. It's not very difficult. But I realize that people are they're doing it to be nice. And so I think that it's definitely the wrong approach for me to get, you know, get annoyed or bitter at them for doing that. I think that that's a reflection of the fact that I think that we've come a long way as a society, that, that people are really trying to look out for the physically disabled. You know, it hasn't always been that way. So I think that it's a little bit awkward, but to me, then that's why I like to just kind of find humor in it and laugh at it. And you know, people always ask me like, oh, well, like, you know, if I saw you, what should I do to help you or whatever? I mean, to me, you know, I'm kind of at the point where I pretty much know what I can and can't do. And most things I can do, but there's a few things I can't do. I can't carry, for example, really large boxes. So I'm going to ask someone for help if I have to carry a really large box, because I know I just can't do it. But anything else, you know, I'm just going to, I can open the door fine by myself. So I don't really need someone to go out of their way to open it for me. And so that's kind of what I tell other people. You know, if you see somebody in a wheelchair or on crutches or whatever, who's like maybe struggling with something, or they ask you for help, and of course help them. But I don't think, generally speaking, you need to go out of your way to try to help them with something they might otherwise be able to do fine on their own.
Your publicity material says one of your speaking topics is the top five things you never knew about being an amputee. Can you enlighten us about one or two of them?
Yeah, it's also one of my other videos as well. But yeah, some of the top five things that you never knew about being an amputee. What I always like to talk about, well, yeah, some of it's actually, you know, a lot of those are became lyrics in the amputee rap about being able to, you know, go out in public and stab your fake leg with a knife.
Yeah,
or, you know, threatening to beat people with your artificial leg or with your crutches. So one of the ones that didn't make it in the top five that I want to make like a sequel to amputee rap, I think, and I want to put in this, that I think that one-legged people can survive a strike of lightning, because you know they always tell you if you think you're going to get struck by lightning to stand on one leg, because then you don't make a circuit with the ground. And so I want to make a song about that, because I think that's pretty awesome.
I'd like to see how you'll do that one with special effects and stuff, perhaps.
yeah, that would be a good special effect.
Josh, really pleased and happy we could speak to you tonight. Thank you.
Hey, thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity to be on the program.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. Thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology. To hear more from Open House, visit openhouseonline.com.au.